It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. On Thursday, March 21st, 2024, a federal appeals court in Boston ordered that the case of Boston Marathon bomber Joker Charnayev be returned to a lower court. Charnayev's lawyers argued that two jurors were dishonest during the jury selection process of the original trial and had lied about discussing or interacting with posts about the case on social media before being seated. In a 2-to-1 vote, the 3-judge panel concluded that the investigation into the claims of juror bias had not been adequately probed. The order keeps Charnayev's death sentence intact for now. However, depending on the investigation of the lower court, a new penalty phase could overturn Charnayev's death sentence. The news comes as a devastating blow to the survivors of the attack, as well as the families of the 3 people killed in the bombing. April 15th marks the 11th anniversary of the attack. Today, I'm joined by the man instrumental in securing the peaceful surrender of Charnayev, retired FBI Special Agent Kyle Voewinkel. You were tasked, Kyle, with the responsibility of securing a peaceful surrender from Charnayev, and to do so, you had to connect with him. What can you tell me about that?
Yes, I'd like to talk about them a little bit first, right? Because this was premeditated actions by them, right? Deliberate, intentional, with known vile consequences. So that planning and preparation they went into that is telling as far as their motive and what they showed, just kind of indifference, callousness towards life. And when law enforcement that night, first backing up on Thursday, the week of the bombing, when they were confronted in Watertown Police by the Watertown Police Department, they reacted by hurling more improvised explosive devices. They fired weapons. So they were continuing to battle with law enforcement, showing no regard for human life. And then at the boat, when hundreds of law enforcement officers swarmed and exchanged gunfire, and it was a very chaotic scene there at the boat that night on Friday, the FBI director ordered the FBI on scene, and we instilled order into the chaos. And he instructed us to try to negotiate. So then it became my job to try to connect with this individual who, again, had shown total disregard for human life, who had done atrocious, horrible things, killing 4 people, Martin Richards, Liu Lingxi, Crystal Campbell, and at the Boston Marathon finish line, and wounding in excess of 250 people, severing limbs, just doing horrific damage. And I now have to treat him as a person, right? I have to put all that aside because it was my job. And more importantly, the FBI wanted to know, were there more bombs out there? Were there more terror cells out there ready to strike? And that's really the primary reason that we wanted to collect that additional intelligence to prevent further acts of terrorism.
So when you receive this order to connect with him for the peaceful surrender in order to ensure that the horrific bombing that had happened at the Boston Marathon would never happen again, what was the first thing that went through your mind? And then how did you deploy your training?
Well, at that point, normally negotiators always travel in pairs. And I was attached with my unit, the FBI hostage rescue team. And in order to get to the crisis site, because we were actually staged at the Arsenal Mall parking lot when we heard the gunfire go off on that initial exchange of gunfire. So we were about 1/4 mile away. Then the word came down to deploy HRT. So I ran to the team leader. I said, hey, can I ride with you? And the team leader said, well, Kyle, I don't know that we'll need negotiators, but hop on board. So that was kind of my first proactiveness of trying to insert us into the situation just in case. Because really up to that point, very few people, myself included, thought that it would be a negotiated resolution because of that extremely violent behavior they demonstrated because of their multiple confrontations with police, from the Sean Collier, the MIT officer they executed, to the Watertown police that they fought it out with. So I wanted to be there, though, just in case. So when HRT deployed then to the boat where he was found, that HRT team leader did a fantastic job instilling order into the chaos. He had to readjust the perimeter. He got control of the units, because prior to our arrival, they'd actually driven up a Massachusetts State Police Bearcat, you know, heavily armored vehicle, very imposing, intimidating, and had a mechanical arm on the front. And they'd approached the boat with that arm, and they tried to flip the boat over off the trailer in order to eject him from the boat. And that didn't work. So they did have a negotiator on a loudspeaker on front of that Bearcat vehicle, and they bellowed out commands, come out, come out, come out. None of that elicited a response. Then the HRT team leader said, let's deploy flashbang devices. Those are non-lethal concussionary devices which emit a massive amount of smoke and light and are 180 decibels. All right, so super loud, super intense, but there's no fragmentation, no damage, just kind of temporarily stuns an individual. So HRT fired a dozen, you know, 12 of those 40 millimeter, which is very large, rounds into the boat, and all 12 rounds hit in the boat. So massive 12 explosions, and he doesn't move. And it was that point when the FBI director, who was monitoring overhead via a drone, and now there's 400 plus law enforcement on scene. I had seen a CNN crew as we were walking in. So I knew everyone and the world was watching. And I was kind of startled when the radio crackled three words, which I will never forget: Kyle, you're up. And I thought, wow, this entire situation, right? The whole nation on edge, terrified Northeast corridor of the United States. And it came down to me to try to connect with him. It was up to me to try to talk with him when all these other efforts had failed. So for the first 30 seconds, as I walked up to my position to start negotiating, the pressure really started building up in me, thinking everything I say and everything I fail to say is going to be second guessed, will be judged. And I most importantly, right, we're going to get him alive to try to prevent any future acts of violence. So after about 30 or so seconds, I told myself, almost like a swipe left. So similar to the old dating apps where you swipe left and remove someone from your view, I had to swipe left in my mind to really remove those thoughts, because there's nothing I could do with those external factors. They're totally out of my control. All those people listening and everyone monitoring my every word, it didn't matter. I focused on my job. My job was to connect with a terrorist in order to save lives. That's the hostage rescue team motto in Latin, servare vitas, which means to save lives. So I walked up the stairs to the second story window, which overlooked him in the boat. So it was about 15 feet from him to me. And remember, we didn't know if he had extra improvised explosive devices in the boat or extra weapons, but nonetheless, we were all there close in the perimeter. And I put my hands, you know, cupped my hands around my mouth and said, introduce myself. My name is Kyle. I'm here to talk with you. Right. So a very non-threatening, non-confrontational attempt to at least establish communications with the subject, which is always our first goal.
And did he respond?
No. 10 agonizing minutes, probably 10 of the longest minutes of my life, because there was no response. So I started to think maybe he's dead, right? And you want to vary your language too, especially if it's one-way communication. So I thought of different ways to phrase the same thing, such as, you know, if you can hear my voice, you know, knock on the bottom of the boat, or if you can hear the words that I'm saying, you know, move the boat cover. There's a plastic white tarp on top of the boat cover, you know, move that. Provide me some sort of signal that you are hearing my words. And of course, FBI headquarters is calling for updates, but the team leader is handling that. Luckily, I'm not dealing with headquarters at this point, but the pressure is that immense that every 10 minutes they're seeking an update, because the whole nation and even the White House, right, is now tracking this. So after 10 minutes, I said, you need to let me know. So I started a little more directive, right? If you can hear me. And he said one word, he said, water, and bingo, right? Now we'd established two-way communications just through my words, me trying to connect with him, me treating him with respect and demonstrating empathy, right? I said, you must be cold. You must be hurt, confused. You're all alone in the boat. As we had known from the helicopter imagery overhead, that there was no one else in the boat with him. And that demonstration of empathy worked. And then he said that, you know, water word. Now, in my mind, I thought, excellent, right? When a subject needs or wants something from law enforcement, that's perfect. That's ideal. So I told him, I have buckets of ice cold water outside the boat, but you have to come off the boat to get it, right? So I'm already trying to compare and contrast the conditions for him. I said, if you stay on the boat, you're going to die on the boat. If you come off the boat, you can live. So it gave him that kind of harsh reality check, but also it gives him a sense of control. We wanted him to choose his fate and understand the consequences of such. And actually, my coach had joined me this time via cell phone. This is kind of funny. I had my phone on vibrate, right? And then it starts ringing at, you know, the 10-minute mark or a little bit earlier. And I look out, it's my partner calling me. I thought, well, this is really an inopportune time, Vince, to be calling me. So I do move away from the window briefly, put the phone in my ear, and I say, yeah, Vince, I'm a little busy right now. And he goes, oh, you're doing a good job, Kyle. Remember to vary your language. Okay, got it. And I hang up. I go back to speaking to the bomber. Maybe like 4 or 5 minutes later, the phone rings again. I thought, boy, this better be important, Vince. I pick up, and he gives me another suggestion. I hang up again. 10 seconds later, he calls me back. It says, Kyle, you dummy, don't hang up. I'm going to coach you just in the background from the phone. I was so singularly focused, right, on connecting with the bomber. And normally the coach is right next to you physically, but we got separated on the initial approach. There's a fence that he was not able to hop over. So anyway, that's why he was then became my coach via the phone. So even I got so kind of myopic on my job, I overlooked that key component of having a coach there. So he's the one that suggested, let's take a timeout. Let's take a pause and let the bomber reflect on his situation, right? Because even though I told those words to him, hey, you're going to stay in the boat, you're going to die in the boat, we wanted that to sink in. We also wanted to have a little kind of powwow huddle with ourselves and with headquarters to update them. So this is maybe the 20-minute mark. And then earlier, this is a key point, I had seen his wrestling coach, Peter Payak, on CNN on Thursday, once the bomber's pictures were identified and released by the FBI. Actually, Wednesday night they were released, but Thursday, the coach went on CNN, and he was the one person that spoke positively about the younger brother. Everyone else, from the uncle to the cousin to other family members who went on the media, spoke very negatively about the bomber. So I reached out, actually found his phone number, cold calling people saying, hi, this is Kyle. I'm really with the FBI. I'm trying to get Coach Payak's phone number. A couple of interesting responses there. They didn't believe me. So I spoke with him Friday morning. This is before the event in the boat. And I spoke with him for about an hour. And I got intimate personal details about the younger bomber from the coach. And I was actually planning on meeting with the coach that Friday night. But then the individual was found in the boat. So Coach Payak this whole time is actually waiting for me at the Arsenal Mall while I'm there at the boat talking to him. But when I re-engaged, this is when I used that information to connect with him, right? I said, I know who you are, Jahar. I talked to your coach. Coach Payak had told me his nickname on the wrestling team was Jahar. So as soon as I said that name, it was like a lightning bolt. I can still feel it to this day. That lightning bolt connected me to him, because now he knew that I knew exactly who he was, and that I knew his background, and that I had taken the time to find out about him, to research him, to talk to his coach. And I told him, you need to come off the boat. And he said, I can't move. I said, you got to pull yourself you know, an inch or two at a time. And he says, I'm badly wounded. And then I shared another key point. I said, I was also a wrestler, Jahar, in high school. You need to finish the match. Finish the match. So he slowly but surely kept crawling over to the side. I kept encouraging him. And this is taking like an hour, so I'm obviously condensing the story here. And he is compliant now, right? He's following my instructions. There's been no new violence, right, since I've begun the negotiations. So things are trending in a exceedingly positive direction. And then he pulls himself up to the edge. He puts his left leg over the edge of the boat, and his right leg is still in the boat. And he's, you can just see he's like wavering, almost going to go out of consciousness, right? He's badly wounded, multiple gunshot wounds over his body, blood everywhere. He says, I can't move my right leg. I said, you got to move the right leg over. Move it over and you're done. You're outside the boat. You're with the friends and family members that love you. You get medical attention. You get water. You get friends and family. Again, comparing and contrasting all those positives outside the boat with all the negatives inside the boat, that he's going to die alone, terrified, no medical help, no supplies if he stays in the boat. But he's teetering on that edge, and I had him lift up his shirt over his head to make sure he was not, did not have a improvised explosive device strapped to his chest. So I'd seen those in my Iraq and Afghanistan deployments where individuals wear those suicide vests. Thankfully, he did not have that. So we could see like 80% of his body, that he had no weapons, that he was unarmed, and it was only really from that right knee down that was not visible to us. So discussing with the team leader, and he asked, do you think he's telling the truth? And I said, yes, I don't think he can move his right leg over. But now it's a totally different situation than when we started, right? We have a controlled scene. Now we have a compliant subject, definitely a lower risk level, right? Now that we can see 80% of his body has no weapons. And again, and he's heeding my instructions. So the team leader, the FBI hostage rescue team leader, did one of the most magnanimous things I've ever seen in a leadership position, knowing full well the FBI and HRT and CNU, the Crisis Negotiation Unit, our group had earned the right to place the handcuffs on the bomber, right? We had successfully persuaded him to come out of the boat. However, he also knew that we were from Washington, D.C., right? We're stationed down at Quantico, and there were local law enforcement officers. You know, MIT had lost their own blood. There have been many wounded local officers. So that team leader said, hey, he cobbled together a 6-person tactical team of Massachusetts and Boston area law enforcement, and he directed them, hey, you guys are going to get to go put the cuffs on him. We're going to work with Kyle, and he'll talk through to the bomber what's going to happen. So I told him, I said, you see the red dots on you, you know, the lasers from the officer's weapons. And he nodded his head yes. And I said, if you follow my instructions, you will live. If you make a quick movement, if you grab something, we will shoot you right where those red dots are. Do you understand? Right, so clearly outlining consequences of his behavior if he doesn't follow what I tell him to do. He said he understood, so they slowly move forward. They're behind a shield. You know, the front man has a shield protecting them. The team leader's right there with him, and the first man grabs his left arm, yanks him off the boat. He's immediately provided medical attention, right? We render first aid to him. He's loaded in the ambulance. And then the team leader asked me to ride back in the ambulance to the Beth Israel Hospital. And I said, sure, since I was the one that connected with him. So I'm sitting right next to him on the gurney, and he's receiving care from the paramedic. And again, he's badly wounded, but he reaches out for my hand. He grabs my hand and squeezes it. So I lean in close because it looks like he's trying to say something, but he has the oxygen mask on, and he's getting shot pretty badly on the side of his face there. And he whispers, how's my brother? How's my brother? If you recall, in Watertown when he was trying to escape. He hopped in the Mercedes SUV and he ran over and killed his own brother. I'm not sure if he knew how badly his brother was wounded or injured. I don't think he was testing me. I think he wanted to know if he was alive or dead. But I also knew that we were going to have to interview him extensively right at the hospital. And there were FBI agents waiting in surgical gowns there for me to hand off custody from me to them. And I didn't want to provide him any information yet. I wanted to withhold that. So I just told him when he asked about his brother, I said, I'll check on it for you. Then after the ambulance ride, we handed him transferred custody. I told those interviewing agents what he'd relayed or what he'd asked. So they were then armed with that information.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
You know, because of this personal connection that you had, for that moment, the connection you forged, do you have thoughts on the death penalty potentially being overturned?
Yes. The two brothers cowardly attacked, right, innocent people at a massive public gathering with multiple IEDs, caused indiscriminate and massive trauma to hundreds of people. Even though I connected with him, it was my job to connect with him. And these guys carried on with their lives after the bombing. After 1 hour from the bombing, he goes to the store and buys milk. They go work out at the gym, goes to dinner with a friend. So their indifference towards human life is just shocking. And they were tried by a jury of their peers who deliberated and rendered a sentence. And I believe that sentence should be carried out.
To hear more from FBI Special Agent VoWinkle, be sure to listen to my past episode, Inside the Bunker, the 2013 Alabama Hostage Crisis. To hear more stories like this, you can listen to our past episodes on the Fox True Crime Podcast. Go to foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts to listen and subscribe. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.